Rex had a really good point last night when he started off talking about how to even talk to this group of people. You ladies are amazing people, but I spend my time in the counseling world. I'm a licensed therapist in the state of Maryland, and I have a certification in trauma, and I think I understand traumatized people, abused people, some, but it's just hard to believe how long-term abuse and trauma can affect the way you think and the way your body reacts to things. And recently I was had a new client, and I was trying to prove to her that I understood how she thought. And so I threw a couple things at her, and I said, "Is this kind of the way you think?" She's like, "Nope." I was like, "All right, let me try again." I said, "How about XYZ?" She's like, "Nope." I was like, after about 10 or 12 tries, I was just like backing down. Finally, I said, "Well, just tell me, you know, what you did as a child for fun. Like, did you guys play games? Did you play tag? Did you?" She's got this look. She's like, "No." I was like, "Well, what did you do for fun when you was little?" And you know what she told me? She said, "The funnest thing we did was look for hiding places from my dad." And you know, I had to back up with her and back up with her and back up with her till we got to that spot. And when she told me that, suddenly I started to realize how she thought. Like, when your favorite childhood game is finding new hiding places, and the thrill of your dad not being able to find you, it affects how, so when you're later in life, you know, she has a hard time connecting with people because it's like she thinks differently. You know, her whole way of thinking is just survival mode. And then when you take that out into the real world, like playing with all these kids up here, that would probably be extremely scary to her. But anyway, so like Breck was saying, we're probably going to step on your toes somewhere along the line. I just ask for forgiveness ahead of time because I'm sure I'm going to do that. One disclaimer is that I do not do marriage counseling. Sorry about that. I just haven't had very much good outcomes with trying to do that. There's a couple people I highly recommend. One would be Baron Miller from California. He would be willing to talk to people. His degree is in marriage and family and relational. My degree is more in social science of mental disorders. Like, it's not as much relational. And also there's a group in Ohio out of Holmes County that call themselves the Restoration Team or Group or something. It's headed up by a fellow by the name of Mark Hostetler. And of all the stuff that I've run onto in the counseling world, and those fellows have a good plan and they're doing a very good job. And it's, they said it was designed by an Amish mechanic And he was very logical, and he's like, if you're working on something, do this step, it don't work, you back up, you do this, and he has this. I'm telling you, it's PhD level stuff that they have, and it it's amazing. And Mark Hostetler is a very, very good man. So I'm just throwing that out there. So I'm supposed to talk about my life story and growth through pain, and I don't know, I really just didn't feel very qualified to talk about it. I feel like I've had pain in my life, but it's not because I was raised in a broken home. It's not because of anything anybody really did to me or not did to me. It seems like most of my pain comes out of my own stupidity, my own hard-headedness, my own mistakes that I've made, my own questions. When I was 20-ish, 21 maybe, I was diagnosed with an obsessive compulsive disorder. And I didn't realize it, but I had worked with things for years that I didn't know there was even a name for it. But when I was 6, maybe, I got into this thing of hand washing. Like we were on dairy farm, like if I'd feed the calves or something, after every calf, I'd have to go wash my hands with soap and da-da-da-da-da and back out and back in. And after a while, my hands were so chapped up and bleeding. And eventually, it was too painful to even wash my hands anymore. So somehow I quit that. I remember, like, if playing in the house, a toy would go under the sofa or something, and I'd have to get in there and get it out. I'd have to run and wash my hands and wash my hands. My hands were just like shiny, smooth, and then they would crack open. And anyway, somehow I got over that, moved on. When I was around 12 years old, have any of you ever heard of the Broderhof or Society of Brothers type of people? So there was a lady that was put out of the community for some reason or another, and she ended up living with a family at our church. And I was just 12 years old, very innocent, and I heard that this lady was depressed and wanted to die, and that was a new concept to me as a 12 years old, that somebody would want to kill themselves. Anyway, one day this family stopped in, and they had this lady with her, with them. And when I saw that lady, something went through my heart that I've never gotten over. I'm still learning about how it affected me. But I never saw somebody so miserable that was still alive. Like, she literally looked like a concentration victim, like walking death. I never seen anybody so hopeless. Like, you could just see it in her. And I remember asking why she was like this. And they're like, well, she thinks that she committed an unpardonable sin. And I was like, what's an unpardonable sin? Oh, he said, blaspheme against the Holy Spirit. I was like, you mean there's a sin that you can't be forgiven of? And that fear just flew into my heart. It was like, and I started like thinking, like, what would that be? Like, this sounds really crazy, but mental illness is crazy. And I started imagining what blaspheme against the Holy Spirit would be. And then the first thing, it's like, well, you thought it. Now maybe you're guilty too, like if you think things. And I just started going down this swirly, like the harder I tried not to think about it, the more I think about it, the more I think about it, and you know, sure, I was going to hell too. And anyway, I realized now, looking back, that I somehow in my compassion for her, I took some of her trauma into myself. It's a child's way of trying to make life easier for the people around them. But anyway, so I struggled around with that for a long time and talked to different people, and it didn't seem like anybody could really give me a good explanation to get out of it. But anyway, I kind of somewhat got over it and pushed on into life. And when I was 19, I started dating my wife, who is my wife now. And I realize now, looking back, I wasn't at a very mature spot in my life. And a couple months, maybe a month or two after that, I had a really bad accident. I was working as a logger, cutting trees, and I pretty near got killed. And I didn't really put this together, but it was like the second time in my life that I had a near-death experience. The first time, when I was 4 years old, my dad was one of the first people that made big round bales back in the late 70s. And he was putting these things into the barn. There's this little bump at the top of the barn hill, and I was riding this little four-year-old on the tractor with him, and he hit that little bump. I flipped off, fell down between the bale mover and the tire, caught by my head. And thankfully, he slammed on the brakes, and my head didn't explode, but I ended up getting stitches and whatnot. And I think that was maybe a little more traumatic to me than I thought. But then you fast forward to my near-death experience at 20. So I was cutting this tree down, and I knew it was a problem tree. It was leaning out over this big boulder. And when you cut a tree off, you always let it hinge, and it kind of hangs on to it lands. Well, it was leaning so bad over this boulder, I knew as soon as it started going, it was going to pop off the stump. So I had myself a place to run and everything, and I cut the thing off. As soon as it started going, I beat it, and I run maybe from here to that wall to my safe spot. And when I thought I was safe, I kind of looked over my shoulder, and that tree had chased me to my safe spot, and it hit me like in the side, and I had a chainsaw in my hand, and it hit me, and it threw me over like that, and the chainsaw came down on my hand and pretty near cut my hand off. But I just remember when I looked over and that thing hit me, I was like, I'm dead, because I thought it was going to land straight on top of me. But for some reason, the tree kind of sprung. Like, I remember hitting the ground and seeing the tree coming at me, and then all of a sudden it went back, boom, and landed right at my feet. So I didn't get killed, but I was shook to the core. Anyway, I ended up in Baltimore, the hand trauma center, and they sewed my hand back together. And but when I was in the hospital there after they did the surgery, and I was just laying there in the hospital bed and thinking about my life and what a mess I was, and my mind just kind of like took off and just racing, like I just couldn't get it to stop. And I started just like breaking out in sweat, and I guess now it would be called a panic attack, I don't know. But I remember, like, I just sweated to beat all, and my sheets were soaked, and this African-American nurse, she come in, and she was checking on me there, and somehow she noticed it. She's like, "What is going on? You're all sweated up." She said, "I'll fix this. Just give me a minute." I was like, "Oh, what's she gonna do?" Pretty soon she came in there, and she had a whole gallon of baby powder. She's like, sit up here. And she just like, I was like, I never knew baby powder did, but it just felt like putting air conditioner on your skin. It just like cooled me off. But anyway, so eventually I got out of the hospital, laid around for a month till I healed up. And by the time I was supposed to get back to work, I was just like in this depressed state of, I didn't feel like doing anything. And I was just disillusioned. And so my dad got me started seeing a therapist that had helped his sister. And anyway, I started recovering. And it was a long road. I think I saw that counselor for over a 7-year period. I might have had like 250 sessions with him or whatever. But it changed my life. And I was like, I don't know if anybody here has ever had anxiety or OCD, but OCD with intrusive thoughts can be pretty painful. Like, you just feel like you're going to hell all the time. Anyway, I was thinking one day, I was like, what would justify all this pain I went through, you know? Being diagnosed with a mental illness, I had to go on medication. Back in those days in my community, like if you had a mental disorder, you were just like, I don't know. It felt to me like a horrible, horrible thing. Nowadays, I don't think it's quite that much stigma with it. I don't know, maybe. But I told my girlfriend about it at the time, and I thought she was going to quit me, and she's like, I'd rather have somebody that's working on a problem than somebody that denies a problem. Yeah. We pulled through that one, and she was crazy enough to marry me. And anyway, so one day I was like, you know, one thing that could maybe be justify all this is that I could pass on to somebody else what was done for me. So I started doing schooling, and my therapist kind of gave me some pointers of where to study and what to go for. And by that time I was married and had couple children and working, and it took me a long time. Like it took me 15 years till I got through a master's degree, which would be 6 years of regular school. So I did it very slow, and it was 2018 till I got licensed and actually started working with people. But anyway, it's kind of been, that's kind of the story of my life. We had a lot of good things happen. We had 5 children running. We took in a foster daughter 12 years ago. And we had a pretty good life it was hard with our foster daughter. We had a lot of chaos and tumultuous times with that court and whatnot. And I gained a real new appreciation for courts. Like, the best thing that ever happened to us to have a judge. We went into court, I can't tell you, different times, shaking in our shoes, sure that this whole thing was going to backfire on us, and we would walk out with everything we asked for. And it was just surreal. I don't know. Kind of like what he was talking about. It's just mind-blowing when you have a judge that is perceptive enough to see what's going on and be like, wow. You hear so many bad stories about judges and foster kids and whatnot, but our experience, it was a lifesaver. Like, when we started, we didn't have, our daughter wasn't in the foster system. It was just her mom asked us to take her, and we didn't have any paperwork, nothing. And I went and talked to our attorney, and he's like, well, you know, you really have no, you know, you're not a relative, you're not nothing other than she asked you to take this child, and if you ever want custody of her, you know, you don't have anything other than if you can have time with her and you take pictures and you can show a judge maybe 3 or 5 years down the road that she's been with your family and all this stuff. So he said, as long as you can make it work, just make it work the way it is. He said, I can't guarantee you how successful it will be in front of the judge. So we did that for a while, and I was nervous. Like her mom's a wild card. And so, and one day, it was maybe 3 or 5 years into it, I was riding to town one day, and she was riding with me, just me and her. And all of a sudden, I got this thought. I was like, you know what? If her birth mom, and she would threaten us with stuff if she didn't like what we were doing, she could report me that I kidnapped her daughter, and I wouldn't have a paper like Rex has to prove anything. As I've run this risk long enough, it's time to do something about it. So I went to the attorney, and he's like, I don't know. He said, you're not related, you're not anything. He said, let me look at my book. So he gets his big log book out, and sure enough, there's a clause in there that says a third party can actually get custody of a child if the right conditions are met. So we went to court. We were given full custody, and we had to have different reviews over the years. So anyway, I'm just telling you that, like, I don't know if any of you's had to go to court over your children or not, but just tell the truth. Just tell the bloody truth. Like, I went one time with a whole, I don't know if I had 12 things that I thought was true. And I was shaking like a leaf, and when the judge gave me a chance to talk, I got through one thing, and I won the court with that one point. I didn't even mention the rest of them. And, you know, they like it whenever somebody tells the truth. So just tell the truth about your situation. I don't care how humbling it is, you'll be farther ahead. Anyway, I feel like early in my life, God gave me a burden to try to help people. And I feel like a lot of the pain that God has brought in my life has been to try to help me be able to understand traumatized, abused, hurting people. And even this last year, I mean, there's some things that have went down that I can't talk about because I'll just start crying and be a mess like I've done here already before, and I don't really want to do it. So there's some things I'm not going to get into, but the only way I can think about it is that it's one thing it is doing, it's helping me understand betrayal, it's helping me understand trauma, it's helping me understand abuse. I feel like in this past year, this is something I can't talk about, but I feel like I've experienced betrayal on a level that I never dreamed possible. completely misunderstood. People trying to have made drastic inroads into my family without even asking questions. I was like, dude, I'm the dad. Can you at least ask my perspective before you try to tell one of my children that I'm not a good parent or I'm not parenting correctly? We have been experiencing a lot of vindication after the fact, but when you're in the middle of it, like I really you know, I've struggled questioning my sanity. You know, people that I trusted the most in my life, like, I felt completely taken advantage of by, and I was like, what in the world is happening? And one of those people just told me this week that I'm too dark. I'm a dark person. And then the next person tells me I think I'm Jesus on rollerblades. So I think maybe I'm bouncing between the two. But anyway, I don't want to be dark today. And so how does this work? And I think the answer is we have to have faith in the resurrection. You know, whenever there's a crazy story in the Bible, in the Old Testament, the children of Israel are out in the wilderness and they've been days without water and they start complaining and complaining about this and complaining about that. Finally, God he sent snakes to bite them. And the snakes bit them and they started dying. And eventually they got really worked up and they went to Moses and they was like, Moses, can you go talk to God and see if you can get God to call off these snakes, you know? So Moses did that. And you would think God would just said, yep, I'll make the snakes stop. But he told him something really, really interesting. He told Moses, he said, you need to go make a brass snake and a pole and put that snake up on the pole and tell those people that if they'll look at the snake, they'll get better. Now, that seems crazy to me to have to look at the thing that's killing you to get better, right? Now, it even gets crazier yet, because you go to the New Testament, and Jesus come along, and he says, just as Moses lifted up that serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That whosoever looks on him and believeth shall be saved. So what's the thing, what is the connection between the serpent in the wilderness and Jesus being on the cross? I think the connection is that when we look at Jesus on the cross, what do we see? To me, we see everything that a human being does not want to face. So what would that be? Well, one thing you see is an early death. Plus, it is, by design, the most horrible death a person can experience. Plus, he was betrayed by his best friend, one of his best friends, with a kiss. Plus, he was killed in front of his mother. Plus, he was innocent. And not only innocent, he was good. And that's a big difference. He was actually good. Plus, he was exchanged for a criminal, a murderer. Plus, he was abandoned by all 12 of his disciples. Plus, he was naked and exposed on that cross. Now, I know there's a lot of artists that like to paint Jesus on the cross with a loincloth, but I didn't think that was the case. I think Jesus was exposed completely naked. And he bore a shame for us that can heal anything we go through. And I've worked with some ladies that have been sexually abused, and possibly some of you here have that too. And sometimes I think, maybe I'm confessing my own self, but sometimes I've wondered, like, there's some people that have told me things that I have to admit, I've wondered if the story of Jesus is big enough for that. But I think if you have a Jesus that doesn't have a loincloth, there's a level of shame there that I think you can trust that he understands. If the story of Jesus isn't big enough, it's because we dumb it down. Plus, he was killed by a foreign occupying nation. Plus, he knew what was coming. He had foreknowledge that it was coming, and he still had to do with it. Like, suppose we knew that next week our husband or wife was going to walk out on us. Phew. It's bad enough when it happens. But if you knew that Tuesday morning, 6:30, he's leaving, or she's leaving, it's something God spares us from. Plus, he was scourged. Plus, he had a crown of thorns. Plus, he was condemned by his own people. We've talked about that some here, too. You know, the difficulty of some people having a church or family that basically rejects you. It's a horrible pain. Plus, he was condemned by the religious. Plus, the high priest condemned him. You know, maybe you could think about your bishop. You know, had a nice talk with the bishop and go away with your tail between your legs. So what happens to this stuff? I want you to think about looking at the cross and looking at Jesus and look at that suffering and look at it and look at it and look deeper and deeper and deeper. What do you see? What do you eventually see? I think what you eventually see is death and resurrection. So the connection is with the snake in the wilderness is if you look at the thing you're afraid of and you stare in the eye, but faith in Jesus Christ, you stare the hard things in your life in the eye, eventually it will back down. And it can be reborn into something positive. So you can think about your husbands, all the horrible things they've done. Think about them as snake bites. Putting that venom in you. And then God says, you have to look at him. We have to look our pain in the eye and stare at it until it backs down. And if you ever go to a therapist, one of the main things we use to help people with fear and anxiety is exposure. So we expose you to it, and we expose you to it, and we expose you to it, and we expose you to it. To finally, it backs down. So I use the example of, I grew up on a farm, and we had this huge tree in our yard. It was like, took three or four people like this to go around it. We called it the Mighty Oak. And we would go up in that tree and make rope swings, and then we'd go up on another branch and jump off, and when we got tired of that, we'd go to a higher branch, and we had a three-tier branches. And, you know, we'd start out on that bottom one, and you'd jump off, and like, whew, this is scary. And then, you know, you did it 10 times, and after a while, wasn't that fun anymore. So then we'd go up on the next branch, jump, wow, this is scary. You know, and then finally we'd go up on the third branch. But what was happening there, by the time you get to the third branch, you're wearing off your fear of that swing, right? It's the same way with your pain. It's the same way with your negative emotions. It's like if you expose yourself to it and you stare it in the eye with the power of Jesus Christ, eventually it's going to die and be reborn. And you see that in Jesus. And the story of Jesus is an archetype for everybody's pain. And I don't want to make it sound too trite, because there's a lot of you all that are, I think we're just going to have to admit that you may go to your grave without being reconciled to your husband. And, or your husband being reconciled to you. And it's going to be reborn someday. And we think about the judgment. I want you all to think about the possibility that the judgment of God is actually more about making things right than it is about punishing evil. There's going to be a restoration. There's going to be a restoration of all things. Even the creation is groaning for restoration. And someday, if your pain doesn't die and be reborn in this life, I promise you it can happen through your death. And that may sound dismal to you, but to me it's exciting to think about that death is the ultimate route to complete healing. Like, we fight and we fight and we fight to stay alive in this world, but I'm convinced if we knew the reality of the complete healing and transformation that we can have through death and to be reborn, we would have more hope. We would be more excited. So, God bless you all, and I certainly enjoy being here. And, you know, just keep putting one foot in front of another. The Galatians, it talks about the law of sowing and reaping. You know, you hear a lot about, well, don't sow to the flesh, you're going to reap of the flesh. And we forget about it. It says, but if you sow to the Spirit, you're going to reap life. And not just a little bit, some 30, some 60, some 90, some 100. And it's a powerful law, the law of the Spirit. It works just as powerfully and accurately as the law of sowing to the flesh. You know, our churches, we have it down to the minute detail, the road to apostasy. We need to get it down to a minute detail, the road to everlasting life. And if you ladies knew that if you took this step, this is going to happen. If you take this step, this is going to happen. And this step, this is going to happen. You would have a lot more confidence. It's real, but I'm going to let the Rex teach you how to do it.